Early the next morning, Jim whistled for Drumfire. He charged up from the bank of the stream where he'd been cropping the young spring grass. In his usual display of affection, he pretended he was going to run his master down. Jim bestowed on him a few affectionate insults while he slipped the bridle over his head. Louisa appeared in the door of the hut.
"Where are you going?"
"To sweep the back trail," he told her.
"What does that mean?"
"I must go back the way we came to make certain we're not being followed," he explained.
"I would like to come with you for the ride."
She looked out at Trueheart.
"Both the horses are well rested."
"Saddle up," Jim invited her.
Louisa had hidden a large chunk of maize bread in the pouch on her belt, but Trueheart smelt it as soon as she stepped out of the door of the hut. The mare came to her at once, and while she ate the bread, Louisa settled the saddle on her back. Jim watched her buckle the girth and mount. She moved easily in her new breeches.
"She must be the luckiest horse in Africa," Jim commented, "to have exchanged the colonel for you. An elephant for a hedgehog."
Jim had saddled Drumfire. He slid a long musket into the sheath, slung a powder horn over his shoulder, then sprang onto Drumfire's back.
"Lead the way," he told her.
"Back the way we came?" she asked, and without waiting for his reply, she started up the slope.
Louisa had a light hand on the reins and a natural seat. The mare seemed not to notice her weight and flew up the steep mountainside. From behind, Jim appraised her style. If she was accustomed to side-saddle, she had adapted readily to riding astride. He remembered how she had endured during the long night ride and was amazed at how quickly she had recovered. He knew that she would be able to keep up, no matter how grueling the pace he set. When they reached the crest, he moved into the lead. Unerringly, he found his way back through the labyrinth of valleys and defiles. To Louisa, each sheer cliff and hillside seemed the same as the one before it, but he twisted and turned through the maze without hesitation. Whenever a new stretch of ground opened before them, he dismounted and climbed to a vantage point to scan the terrain ahead through the lens of his telescope. These halts gave her respite to enjoy the grand scenery that surrounded them. After the flat country of her native land, these mountain tops seemed to reach to the heavens. The cliff walls were umber, red, and purple. The scree slopes were densely clad with shrubs. Some of their flowers looked like huge pincushions, and the colours were daffodil yellow and brilliant orange. Flocks of long-tailed birds swarmed over them, probing their curved beaks deeply into the flowers.
"Suikerbekkies, sugarbeaks," Jim told her, when she pointed them out.
"They're drinking the nectar from the protea bushes."
It was the first time since the shipwreck that she'd been able to look around her, and she felt drawn by the beauty of this strange new land. The horrors of the Mew's gun deck were already fading, seemed now to belong to an old nightmare. The path they were following climbed another steep slope, and Jim stopped below the skyline and handed her Drumfire's reins to hold while he climbed to the crest to observe the far side of the mountain. She watched him idly. Suddenly his manner changed abruptly. He ducked down, doubled over, and scrambled back to where she waited. She was alarmed, and her voice shook.
"Are we being followed? Is it the colonel's men?"
"No, it's much better than that. It's meat."
"I don't understand."
"Eland, herd of 20 or more, coming straight up the far side towards us."
"Eland?" she asked.
"The largest antelope in Africa, as big as an ox," he explained, as he checked the priming in the pan of the musket. "The flesh is rich with fat and closer to the taste of beef than any other antelopes. Salted and dried or smoked, the flesh of a single eland will last us many weeks."
"Are you going to kill one? What if the colonel is following us? Won't he hear the shot?"
"In these mountains the echoes will break up the sound and confuse the direction. In any event, I cannot miss this opportunity. We're already short of meat. I must take the chance if we are not to starve." He took hold of the bridles of both horses and led them off the path, then stopped behind an outcrop of raw red rock.
"Dismount. Hold the horses' heads, but try to stay out of sight. Don't move until I call you," he ordered Louisa. And then, carrying the musket, he ran back up the slope.
Just before he reached the crest, he dropped into the grass. He glanced back and saw that she had followed his instructions. She was squatting down so that only her head was visible.
"The horses will not alarm the eland," he told himself. "The eland would take them for other wild game."
With his hat, he wiped the sweat out of his eyes and wriggled down more comfortably behind a small rock. He was sitting, not lying flat. Fired from the prone position, the recoil of the heavy musket might break his collarbone. He used his hat as a cushion and laid the stock of the musket on it, aiming up the slope. The profound silence of the mountains settled over the valley. The soft hum of insects in the protea blossoms and the lonely, plaintive whistle of a red-winged mountain starling sounded abnormally loud. The minutes passed as slowly as honey dripping. Then Jim lifted his head. He had heard another sound that made his heartbeat trip. It was faint clicking, like dry sticks being tapped together. Jim recognized it instantly. The eland antelope has a peculiar characteristic unique in the African wild. The mighty sinews in its legs make a strange click with each step it takes. Bakat, the little yellow bushman, had explained to Jim, when he was a child, how this had come about. One day, in that far-off time, when the sun had risen on the first day, and the world was new with the dew still fresh upon it, Chtok, who was the father of all the Khoisan, the bushman, caught in his cunning snare Impisi, the hyena. As all the world knows, Impisi was and still is a powerful magician. As Chtok was sharpening his flint knife to cut his throat, Impisi said to him, "Chtok, if you set me free, I will make a magic for you. Instead of my flesh, which stinks of the carrion I eat, you will have hills of white fat and mountains of the sweet meat of the eland roasting on your fire every night of your life." "How can this be, O hyena?" Chtok had wondered, although he was beginning to drown in his own saliva at the thought of the eland meat. But the eland was a cunning animal and difficult to find. "I will place a spell on the eland so that whenever he roams over desert and mountain, he will make a sound that will guide you to him." Thus Chtok had set Impisi free, and from that day onwards the eland has clicked as he walks to warn the hunter of his approach. Jim grinned as he remembered Bakat's story. Gently he drew back the heavy hammer of the musket to full cock and settled the brass-bound butt into his shoulder. The clicking sounds grew louder, stopping as the animals that made them paused, then coming on again. Jim watched the skyline just ahead of where he lay, and suddenly a massive pair of horns rose against the blue. They were as long and thick as a strong man's arm, spiralling like the horn of the narwhal, polished black so the sun glinted upon them. The clicking sound ceased, and the horns turned slowly from side to side, as if the animal that carried them was listening. Jim heard his breath whistling in his ears, and his nerves tightened like the string of a crossbow. Then the clicking sound began again, and the horns rose higher, until two trumpet-shaped ears and a pair of huge eyes appeared beneath them. The eyes were dark and gentle, seeming to swim with tears. Long, curling lashes veiled them. They stared directly into Jim's soul, and his breath stopped. The beast was so close that he could see it blink, and he dared not move. Then the eland looked away, swinging his great head to stare down the slope up which it had come. Then it started forward towards Jim, and the rest of its body came into view. He could not have circled that thick neck with his arms. A heavy dewlap hung beneath it, swinging ponderously with each pace. Its back and shoulders were blue with age, and it stood as tall as Jim himself. Only a dozen paces from where he sat, it stopped and lowered its head to pull the new spring leaves from a cripplewood bush. Over the ridge behind the bull, the rest of the herd came into view. The cows were a soft, creamy brown, and although they carried the long spiral horns, their heads were more graceful and feminine. The calves were a ruddy chestnut, the younger ones hornless. One dropped its head and butted its twin playfully. Then they bucked and chased each other in a circle. The mother watched with mild disinterest.
The hunter's instinct drew Jim's eyes back to the great bull. It was still chewing the cripplewood. It was an effort for Jim to reject this old animal. Despite the mighty trophy it carried, its flesh would be tough and gamey, its fat sparse. Buckat's philosophy came back to him. Leave the old bull to breed and the cow to suckle her young. Slowly, Jim turned his head to examine the rest of the herd. At that moment, the perfect quarry came up over the ridge. This was a much younger bull, not more than 4 years old. His hindquarters so plump they seemed to be bursting from his glossy golden brown hide. He turned aside, attracted by the shiny green leaves of the gwari tree. The branches were laden with ripe purple berries, and the young bull moved round until he was facing Jim. Then he stretched up to nibble at the berries, exposing the creamy curve of his throat. Jim traversed the barrel of the musket towards him. His movements were as slow as the advance of a chameleon on a fly. The frolicking calves kicked up dust and distracted the usually watchful gaze of the cows. Carefully, Jim laid the bead of the foresight on the base of the bull's throat. On the crease of skin that encircled it like a necklace. He knew that even at such close range, either of the beast's massive shoulder blades would flatten and stop the musket ball. He had to find the gap in the animal's brisket through which he could drive the deep ball into the vitals to tear through the heart, lungs, and pulsing arteries. He took up the slack in the trigger and felt the resistance of the sear. Steadily he increased the pressure, staring hard at his aiming point on the throat, resisting any impulse to jerk the trigger that final hairbreadth. The hammer fell with a loud snap, and the flint struck a shower of sparks off the frizzen. The powder in the pan ignited in a puff of white smoke, and with a bass roar the butt slammed back into his shoulder. Before he could be unsighted by the heavy recoil and the gush of powder smoke, Jim saw the eland hump its back in a mighty spasm. He knew from this that the ball had sliced through its heart. He sprang to his feet to see over the bank of smoke. The young bull was still frozen in agony, its mouth gaping. Jim could see the bullet wound, a dark, bloodless hole in the smooth hide of the throat. All around him, the rest of the herd burst into flight, scattering away down the rocky hillside in a mad gallop, loose stones and dust flying from under their hoofs. The stricken bull backed away, racked in a gigantic contortion. Its legs shook and quivered, and it sank back on its haunches. It lifted its head to the sky, and the bright lung blood sprayed from its gaping jaws. Then it twisted over and fell on its back, all four legs kicking spasmodically in the air. Jim stood and watched the beast's last throes. His jubilation was gradually replaced by the melancholy of the true hunter, caught up in the beauty and tragedy of the kill. As the eland subsided and was still, he laid aside the musket and drew the knife from its sheath on his belt. Using the horns as a lever, he pulled back the beast's head, and with two expert incisions he laid open the arteries on each side of the throat and watched the bright blood flow out. Then he lifted one of the massive back legs and cut away the scrotum. Louisa rode up as he straightened with the furry white pouch in his hand. He felt bound to explain. "It would taint the flesh if we left it." She looked away. "What a magnificent animal! So big!" She seemed subdued by the enormity of what he had done. Then she sat up straighter in the saddle. "What must I do to help you?" "Tether the horses first," he told her, and she swung down from True Heart's back and led the horses to the gwari tree. She hitched them to the trunk, then came back. "Hold one of the back legs," he said. "If we leave the guts inside, the meat will sour and spoil in a few hours." It was heavy work, but she did not flinch from it. When he made the paunching stroke from the crotch to the ribs, the bowels and entrails came ballooning out of the opening. "This is when you get your hands messy," he warned her. But before he could go on, another voice spoke near at hand, a piping, childlike voice. "I taught you well, Samoya." Jim spun round, the knife held instinctively in the underhand defensive grip, and stared at the little yellow man who sat on a rock watching them. "Back at you, little shatan!" Jim shouted, more in fright than anger. "Don't ever do that again! Where in the name of the Kulukulu did you come from?" "Eh, did I startle you, Samoya?" Buckhart looked uncomfortable. And Jim remembered his manners. He had come close to giving offence to his friend. "No, of course not. I saw you from afar." You must never tell a bushman that you had overlooked him. He will take it as an insulting reference to his tiny stature. "You stand taller than the trees." Buckhart's face lit up at the compliment. "Ha! I watched you from the beginning of the hunt. It was a fair stalk and a clean kill, Samoya. But I think you need more than a young girl to help you dress the meat." He hopped down from the rock. He paused in front of Louisa and crouched down, clapping his hands in greeting. "What is he saying?" she asked Jim. "He says that he sees you and that your hair is like sunlight," he told her. "I think you have just been given your African name. Welanga, girl of sunlight. Please tell him that I see him also and that he does me great honour." She smiled down at him, and Buckhart cackled with delighted laughter. Buckhart carried a native axe hooked over one shoulder and his hunting bow over the other. He laid aside the bow and quiver and hefted the axe as he came to help Jim with the huge carcass. Louisa was amazed at how quickly the two of them worked. Each knew his job and did it without hesitation or argument. Bloody to their elbows, they drew out the entrails and the bulging sack of the stomach. With barely a check in the work, Buckhart cut a strip of the raw tripes. He slapped it against a rock to knock off the half-digested vegetation, then stuffed it into his mouth and chewed with unfeigned relish. When they pulled out the steaming liver, even Jim joined in the feast. Louisa stared in horror. "It's raw," she protested. "In Holland, you eat raw herring," he said, and offered her a sliver of the purple liver. She was about to refuse, then saw from his expression that this was a challenge. She hesitated still until she realized that Buckhart also was watching her with a sly smile, his eyes slitted between leathery wrinkles. She took the slice of liver, gathered her courage, and placed it in her mouth. She felt her gorge rise, but forced herself to chew. After the first shock of the strong taste, it was not unpleasant. She ate slowly and swallowed it. To her deep satisfaction, Jim looked crestfallen. She took another slice from his bloody hand and began to chew at it. Buckhart let out a squeal of laughter and dug his elbow into Jim's ribs. He shook his head with delight, mocking Jim and miming the way she had won the silent contest, staggering around in a circle as he crammed imaginary lumps of liver into his mouth with both hands, weak with mirth. "If you were half as funny as you think you are," Jim told him sourly, "you would be the wit of all the 50 tribes of the Khoisan. Now let's get back to work." They divided up the meat into loads for both the horses, and Buckhart made a sack of the wet skin into which he stuffed all the titbits of kidneys, tripes, and liver. It weighed almost as much as he did, but he shouldered it and set off at a trot. Jim carried a shoulder of the eland, which almost buckled his knees, and Louisa led the horses. They covered the last mile down the gorge to Majuba in darkness.